The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, June 12, 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette discusses the continuing fallout from a scandal involving former and current state legislators, bribes, and GIF money. That's later on Ozarks. In about an hour on 91.3 on NPR's Here and Now, the show's go-to literary guy, Steve Allman, has his annual list of summer reads that are accessible but still make you think, including Florida, a short story collection from Lauren Groff. His picks on Here and Now from 1 to 3 this afternoon on 91.3. And we'll have our second summer book recommendation from Pastor Clint Schneckloth in the second half hour of today's Ozarks at Large. And in a few hours at Fort Smith Brewing, a national brewing comedy tour arrives. More than 100 breweries across the country are involved, and some of the top young comics are involved as well. Tonight, Fort Smith Brewing hosts a stop of this tour from 7:30 to 9:30 at their address at 7500 Fort Chaffee Road. This is Ozarks at Large. The Mulberry River, a rugged tributary of the Arkansas, is a lesser-known Ozark stream compared to the Buffalo or the White. That's where the nonprofit conservation group, the Mulberry River Society, works. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich attended a recent society gathering along the river, and she brings us this story.
On a sweltering Ozarks June afternoon, the 70-mile-long Mulberry River, which surges through deep rocky narrows and meanders over shallow gravel beds, is a favorite respite for humans and wildlife. Upstream along the Little Mulberry on Susan Gately's picturesque Ozarks farm, 18 members of the Mulberry River Society wrap up new business before enjoying a picnic feast.
Thank you for that. We do need to agree upon a time sometime in July for a meeting, okay?
Hugh Ernest, president of the Mulberry River Society, established in the winter of 2014, recites the mission.
Conservation, appreciation, recreation, education, and stewardship. CARES, C-A-R-E-S. And we're very, very committed to that.
The society counts more than 150 members, mostly from Franklin and Johnson counties.
We have a very clean watershed. We want to keep it that way.
Susan Gately serves on the Water Quality Committee.
What's neat about the Mulberry is in the summertime where the trees just form a canopy over the river, and it's just this blue, it's a unique color. It's blue-green. I don't know how to describe it. It's just this unique blue-green color, and I don't see that anywhere else. The Mulberry and the Little Mulberry are the two that you really see that.
But the river, Gately says, is in trouble. She conducts stream team monitoring, documenting aquatic life and water quality.
Water quality monitoring on pH, nitrates, dissolved oxygen. And we've been doing this for about 6 years, I think. Phosphates, we check that. Turbidity, we do all of that as part of our quarterly monitoring. And we've kept the results on all this. We score pretty good, except on one thing, and the pH has been a little bit of a problem. We've been having declining pHs. Not sure why.
Low pH can affect fish living in the river, large and smallmouth bass, red-eared sunfish, gar, and catfish.
The fish do not spawn at lower pHs.
As a consequence, the Mulberry River is declared impaired by the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality. That agency, Hugh Ernest says, is committed to helping resolve the mysterious acidity issue. USDA scientists based at the University of Arkansas at first investigated increasing pine density, pine trees, due to decreasing hardwood tree growth in the watershed, as well as atmospheric nitrogen deposition. Society member Ron Robbins is a state-registered petroleum engineer and Mulberry River property owner.
Yes. There's been studies at the university on the pine litter overall, because the Ozarks are changing to a predominantly pine stand, and they're thinking that that is not what's driving it lower. The upper portion, there's also natural gas production.
More than 5,000 unconventional gas wells were drilled, fracked, in the mid to late 2000s across the Fayetteville Shale on six counties east of here. That petroleum play now lies mostly dormant.
But the impairments on both sides of the upper part of the Mulberry, the north side and the south side of the river, and there's no oil and gas production activity on the north side of the river.
Where the Mulberry headwaters are located.
The headwaters are up at Fallsville, where all the headwaters are for the Ozarks, right? The Kings River and the White River and the Buffalo River and the Piney River.
The Mulberry River drains 370 square miles of mostly Ozark National Forest land. In 1992, the Mulberry was designated as a National Wild and Scenic River by Congress. The lower half of the river is a popular seasonal whitewater route for paddlers, including the governor of Arkansas, who recently floated the Mulberry to celebrate Earth Day and the completion of two significant river access improvement projects facilitated by the Mulberry River Society. Susan Gately.
The Mulberry River Society organized a dedication of the Indian Creek canoe access and the High Bank canoe access, because we rebuilt those with the help of the Forest Service. And we kind of timed it with the 50th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic River Act. And so we had a big celebration. That was in April, and the governor was there. Some of our senators were there, and we dedicated the two canoe accesses.
Partnering with the Ozark National Forest Service, the Arkansas Canoe Club, and the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, the Society installed massive cut rock walls and pavers up to the river's edge designed to withstand flood events. Circular drives were also constructed, lots of parking and interpretation, including local history. Paleo cultures first inhabited the watershed 13,000 years ago, later settled by woodland and Mississippian tribes, Quapaw, Caddo, and Osage. First contact with Europeans occurred in the mid-1500s here. Dina Turner, a local attorney, can trace her family's roots back six generations. She's a board member and education coordinator for the Mulberry River Society.
I've just been a part of it since its inception, and I love it so much. It's just as deep, we have as deep a roots in this as anything, because the people that are all a part of it all do have deep roots in here, or a very strong connection to the river, the area, the valley, and it's really wonderful to be a part of it.
Turner's grandparents established Turner Bend Grocery Store, which continues to operate, serving both locals and tourists.
But my grandfather did have 23 brothers and sisters in this area, so I have lots of other people that share this with me. And so it's wonderful.
Turner says she's grateful the Mulberry was never dammed.
Yes, there was definitely an attempt to dam it. And fortunately, we did just present to Governor Pryor a Lifetime Achievement Award, David Pryor, thanking him, expressing our deep heartfelt gratitude for saving the river from damming. In the 70s, I believe it was, when he was acting governor, there was a movement and a push for that, and he was able to get the river into a study, and the study was going to take, you know, upwards of 5 to 6 years, and so plans to dam went elsewhere. And as a result of that, then it's turned out the study was to determine if we could become part of the Wild and Scenic, receive the designation as a National Wild and Scenic River.
Mulberry River Society Secretary and founding member Cheryl Perry says recreational river access will remain a priority for the group.
We hope to continue more of these access points on the river that need help. The Forest Service is kind of guiding us in a way, because they are the ones that really are responsible for a lot of these. And so I think that between Indian Creek and High Bank, that we've kind of cemented a nice relationship, so that they're more open to say, hey, yeah, can y'all help us with this next project?
Most of the members of the Mulberry River Society are middle-aged and older now. Cheryl Perry's spouse, Tom, a key member, recently passed away. So legacy is a concern.
one of the things that Tom and I, my husband was Tom Perry, and he was very excited about working, doing the rock work on all of these projects that we've done so far, and he was very active in that process. But I think one of the things that he and I both loved was the CCC stuff, the Civilian Conservation Corps. And we used to go around and find the bridges and the cabins and all the little walls and stuff, and we would be so excited, and we'd think, you know, I wonder who laid these, because he was a rock man, and he just loved it. And he was like, I just wonder whose hands were on these? Where did they find these stones? And you know, about the people that had actually done the work. And so he kind of had this vision that he wanted to be part of a group that could leave something just like that, similar to that, for future generations. And I think we're going to be able to do that.
Susan Gately says the Society plans to carefully reach out to landholders along the river to build coalition.
It's tricky to do because as a landowner myself, I really don't want somebody telling me what I can do with my land. But on the other hand, we have to be good stewards. And we have to take care of what we've got. We have to take care of our riparian zone. We have to prevent erosion. These are all things that we need to work on.
The Mulberry River Society meets monthly. They welcome new members. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Learn more about the Mulberry River Society at Ozarks at Large. There you can view a slideshow illustrating the report you just heard, and we have links to many of the interviews and news stories you hear on Ozarks at Large at ozarksatlarge.com. In case you missed it, the Arkansas Razorbacks are heading to the College World Series in Omaha that begins this weekend. Last night, the Razorbacks won the deciding game in their Super Regional against South Carolina, 14-4 at Baum Stadium. Arkansas will open play in the College World Series against an old antagonist, Texas, Sunday afternoon. The Razorbacks' trip to the CWS is the school's ninth. Texas is in the College World Series for a record 36th time.
91.3 is supported by the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. The latest edition features contractors and subcontractors, plus local business news in Northwest Arkansas. Subscriptions available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com. The 11th annual Art in the Garden at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks takes place Friday, June 15th, beginning at 6:30 p.m. This year's honorary art patrons are Jim and Nancy Blair. The evening will include an art display and sale, plus live music, food, wine, craft beer, and spirits. Proceeds support the Botanical Garden's educational programs and services. bgozarks.org for limited tickets or for information. KUAF Summer Night Swing, a live concert and fundraising event, takes place Friday, June 22nd from 7 to 10 p.m. Local musicians will perform, including Claudia Burson, Ed Nicholson, Ben Harris, Ezra Eidlett, and Keith Grimwood of Trout Fishing in America. It's a celebration of local music featuring the two longest-running programs on 91.3, Shades of Jazz and The Pick and Post. KUAF Summer Night Swing, live and on the air Friday, June 22nd, 7 to 10 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, how rockabilly legend and Arkansas native Sonny Burgess made a name for himself.
45 RPM record has a song on it. It lasts for less than 3 minutes. Has to. That's the size of the record. You can't play more than 3 minutes of one song on one side of an RPM record, a 45. Sonny's group, the Pacers, would take that same song, We Want a Boogie, or Going Home, or A Redhead Woman, and play that song live in a dance hall for 45 minutes to 1 hour.
Marvin Schwartz will discuss his book, We Want a Boogie, The Rockabilly Roots of Sonny Burgess and the Pacers, later on this Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large. Last week, more revelations in an ongoing investigation into legislators, bribes, general improvement funds, and more. A lobbyist entered a guilty plea to a federal charge and, in doing so, implicated a sitting legislator identified as Senator A as playing a part in the matter. This week, John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, discussed the latest developments with Roby Brock, who is with our partner, Talk Business and Politics. They not only talk about the latest twists, but also what, if anything, can be done to limit influence of lobbyists and reduce the potential for corruption in the state legislature. Roby started the conversation with a brief recap of the latest news.
Rusty Cranford, the lobbyist at the center of this controversy, changes his plea last week and indicts or incriminates a Senator A. Mm-hmm. in the process, which, by all deductive reasoning, is Senator Jeremy Hutchinson.
Could only be.
How is this different in terms of what we've been seeing unfold with John Woods, with Micah Neal, and with others?
Well, in a couple of ways. One, I remember back during the Woods trial, I was waxing indignant about this whole general improvement fund, which has been a theme of mine and many other people for years, just the way the legislators would take shares of the surplus money unto themselves, and then the willy-nilly way we let them handle it, and how it was an invitation for corruption, and it had been manifest in corruption. And I got an email from a person close to that investigation who said, you need to save some powder, because this is the least of it. General improvement is kind of peanuts, important peanuts and corrupt peanuts. This is bigger because this isn't particularly, the bill of information that was presented in connection with Cranford's copped plea to one charge lays out not kickbacks necessarily, just a corrupt culture, really, in which legislators are financially involved in intricate ways with a network of nonprofits that receive Medicaid money primarily, which gets you into hundreds of millions of dollars in reimbursements, most of it matched by the federal government, which interests federal authorities, and it has to do with some sort of implied corruption, particularly in regard to Senator A. Hutchinson. He's not indicted as yet, conceivably never will be, because most of the $500,000 this bill of information accuses him of taking has to do with retainers. He was paid $9,000 a month for 4 years, $7,500 a month in a fifth year. Add that up, that's basically your $500,000.
And he's an attorney.
He's an attorney, and under Arkansas law and legislative rules, services. And under legislative rules, our lawyer legislators are allowed to have clients and make a living under the premise that they're part-time legislators. So what I understand is happening right now is the FBI is trying to force Jeremy Hutchinson through his lawyers to verify services extended for this money, which is not easy to do because the purpose of a retainer means so much. You get money every month, even if that month you didn't have that much to do.
Right.
That's the idea of a retainer. Receiving retainers from a business reaping hundreds of millions of dollars ought to be illegal, ought to be against the rules, but is not. So this is, somebody said, how is this different from Nick Wilson's deal? And I replied, Nick Wilson masterminded his own deal as a legislator. In this one, a lobbyist, a well-connected lobbyist serving a network of tax receivers, masterminded it and used a couple of legislators as knights and maybe another one as a bishop in a chess game. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the difference.
So what is the Cranford plea deal? Really doesn't change anything for Woods or Neal.
No.
Or Hank Wilkins. They all had either been convicted or admitted something. So
that's essentially adjudicated, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this one senator? Do you think this is
that's
going to come out of this?
Here's what, you take all of this, these 43 pages of remarkable allegation and insight into these maneuverings, and basically it's all, while interesting, known, except the part involving Senator A. Hutchinson. And the people familiar with lawyers, familiar with federal prosecutions, tell me it's obvious what happened here. Cranford faced a myriad charges, and through good lawyering, he copped a plea to one charge. Federal program bribery, which ain't small potatoes and can get you 10 years, but it's less than he might. And in exchange for that, he did what private sector culprits sometimes do. They gave up a politician with a big name. He gave him Jeremy Hutchinson. He said, they wanted something. The name Hutchinson is at a good name to go after if for the federal authorities to make a point? Yeah, it is. So, but whether what he gave them amounts to an indictable, much less a convictable series of offenses remains to be seen. To me, it reveals what another senator, whose name I won't mention, told me. He said, we're broken around here. We're not the only state legislature with this kind of trouble inside the Capitol. But there is entirely a culture that could allow these kinds of financial associations to happen between lobbyists wandering around in the Capitol corridors and people elected to serve us and to appropriate hundreds of millions of dollars. It is a corrupt system. One thing Hutchinson is accused of doing, for example, is, and you tell me if this is legislating or if this is a criminal activity. Cranford, in an email, says to some of his folks, the bill that came out of the House today, we're going to get that held up in the Senate, and Hutchinson and Wilkins are going to lean on Human Services to change the way that they have these rating systems for recipients of this behavioral health money. Mm-hmm. Now, was Hutchinson acting as a legislator concerned about a policy when he...
Right.
Or was he doing what Cranford told him to do pursuant to the retainer he was paid?
Yeah.
You're looking for quid pro quo.
Will there be a paper trail that can verify that one thing happened or another thing happened? And I do think that there will be some other side to this story that will eventually come out, whether that is Jeremy Hutchinson or his lawyer talking, or whether it is in court documents or an eventual trial. We're going to learn more about all of this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, getting back to the kind of the culture of the Capitol here, because you and I have seen this for decades. Right. This is not the first time we've seen this type of ethical dilemma here. And you do get into this situation, and this is not apples to apples, but you've got insurance agents, for instance, or real estate agents that are part-time legislators, and they're running legislation that affects the insurance and the real estate industry. You want somebody with knowledge of these industries doing these things, but they could be running bills that are going to be beneficial to them. There is no way to correct that unless you just go to a full-time legislature that is not going to happen politically in Arkansas. So I don't see where the solution finally presents itself. If you create more ethical laws, it's like water running downhill. It's still going to find a way to get through. We've seen it decade after decade after decade.
It's going to be a tricky thing to do, but I think something's going to be done in the way of new legislative rules regarding lawyers, the number of which has been reducing precipitously in the legislature in recent years.
Well, what's to keep it from being consultants? I mean, again, I'm
splitting
a
better written rule and better and more ethical people. Here's the thing, and I'll just invoke a big name for purposes of making this point. One thing I heard last week from many of Hutchinson's friends was, when Mike Beebe was in the legislature, sort of the head honcho of the Senate, his law firm in Searcy was believed to be on retainer from first Arkansas Power and Light Company and then Entergy. What's the difference between that and Jeremy Hutchinson being on retainer to the nonprofit behavioral health providers lobbied for by Cranford? In some ways, not much. In another way, sort of key. It's my understanding that BB joined a law firm that had long been politically connected and had long held this simple retainer from APNL, like at times they said nearly every lawyer in the legislature had a retainer from APNL. But it was
And there was a lot of energy deregulation and a lot of bills that were out there for voting on as well as sponsoring.
It's not good. But there is a little bit of a difference. In fact, there's more than a little bit of a difference in joining a law firm as a young lawyer that has a retainer from a big corporate business that has lobbying interest and then get elected to the Senate. That's not ideal. That's far from ideal. But Jeremy Hutchinson had been in the legislature, had been in the House, was in the Senate, made the acquaintance of Cranford, and Cranford then hired him. You see?
Sure.
There is a difference. You've got to see that. And what was the purpose of hiring? And a rule that would that would disallow this midterm hiring on to a new client who is engaged in lobbying the legislature. I'm not sure that's a difficult rule to write.
Yes. It can be written, yes. But there will still be challenges, and suspect that there will still be loopholes.
And corruption will find a way, and right. People will find a way to get money paid.
It might not even be corruption that finds a way. It may be capitalism finds a way to make this happen. So,
well, okay. If capitalism and corruption, I hope, are two different things.
They are.
I hope you can find a line in there somewhere. There.
John Brummett is a political writer with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns can also be found at ArkansasOnline.com. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. There is more from the conversation at TalkBusiness.net. Also there, more news regarding Arkansas's political and financial landscapes. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Opera in the Ozarks presents its 68th season June 22nd through July 20th at Inspiration Point in Eureka Springs, featuring 22 performances of three fully staged operas, including De Fledermaus, The Barber of Seville, and The Ballad of Baby Doe. Sunday performances held at Arts Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. Tickets and schedule at opera.org. Theater Squared presents the Arkansas New Play Festival, the state's celebration of new American plays with playwrights in residence through June 17th. Events and performances take place in both Bentonville and Fayetteville, featuring two weekends of performances, free events, and local craft beer. Seating is limited. 443-5600 or theater2.org for tickets.
Last August, Sonny Burgess died. He's an Arkansas legend, even if he's not exactly a household name in every household. He spent decades as a rockabilly star who achieved his biggest fame in and around the Arkansas Delta in the 1950s and later in the 1980s in Europe as a rockabilly revival took hold. In his book, We Want a Boogie, The Rockabilly Roots of Sonny Burgess and the Pacers, Marvin Schwartz tells the story of how Sonny Burgess wowed audiences and maintained his Arkansas roots. Schwartz will discuss his book June 26th at the Fayetteville Public Library as part of the summer author series at the library. Last week, we talked to him about the book. It not only chronicles Sonny Burgess's life and career, but also concentrates on the heydays of Newport, Arkansas, a river town that thrived in the first half of the century and was still an agricultural hub in the 50s, as it was also becoming a hotbed for music.
And there's a heritage there that really preceded and set up the heyday of the 1950s. People think of the Sun Records era and all the hep cats that came out of Sun Records, Elvis and Cash and Orbison and Jerry Lee and others. They came to Newport because the clubs there would pay them fairly well, pay them more than they could make in Memphis. The reason they came to there were big clubs in Newport was because the heritage of the river town had created a scenario where back in the steamboat era, back in the post-Civil War 1880s, there were gangs of men that worked the river, that cut the timber, that hauled the cotton. They would dock at Newport. They would come up these gangways up the muddy slopes and hit the bordellos and the houses of ill repute, which in that time was considered almost reputable. It's bragged about in the newspapers that how many of these houses there were along the river. So they played music. There were women of their trade there, and there were working men that came there. And then as the railroad came in, then circuses came in, and other forms of entertainers came in. So Newport always had a history of being a somewhat rambunctious river town. The big, big boom that brought Newport up to its height was World War II. And suddenly Newport was the host of the service industry to the military personnel. An air base was built east of town, and the town doubled in population from 4,000 to 8,000 people in a couple of years. So by 1942, 1944, the town was swarming with military personnel. There was an air base there. And these young men and all the support that provided them in this whole community, they were working. They had money in their pockets. They were what we would call our Top Gun pilots. They were flying an A-25, which was one of the fastest planes in the air in World War II. And these guys were looking for fun. And fun translating meaning women and music. And so the smart money in Newport began building clubs to accommodate these flyers. And these clubs were often on the outskirts of town, a little bit north or outside of the city limits, making enforcement a little more difficult. But clubs like the Silver Moon and clubs like Mike's Place and Bob King's Place in Swifton and Tuckerman were built because the military personnel wanted someplace to go to drink and to dance. Well, that's not all that happened at these clubs, because in the back rooms, they were gambling sites. And this was also extraordinarily well known and tolerated. There were some payoffs that allowed this to continue through the authorities. But these clubs now were generating a tremendous amount of activity. They had a place where you could drink and dance, and they had a place in the back rooms, and virtually all of them had a backroom gambling site. So they're generating a lot of money, and they could afford to bring in entertainers and pay them fairly well. So at the same time this is happening, in Memphis, Sam Phillips, an entrepreneur musical genius, is creating his studio, and he's putting on record the sounds and the voices of a whole new generation of black and white musical talent. These folks, mostly the white folks, of course, could come to Newport and play in the clubs that were flourishing there.
And a lot of these factors, if not all of them, kind of form into who Sonny Burgess would become. He came from a place, it was called Anderson, but the nickname was the Sand, right?
Correct, right. It was the bottom lands of the Black River. So fairly rich agricultural site, very good for melons and other crops that needed soft ground. Cotton requires a little firmer soil, a little drier soil. But his family raised cotton, but mostly they raised vegetables. But his future would have been in farming. He had a particular athletic ability. He had a chance to become a baseball player, and that was another way out of farming. But any way other than being a farmer was attractive to the young men at that time. So Sonny came from a very traditional home that was rooted in the ground.
I'm talking with Marvin Schwartz. He is the author of We Want a Boogie, The Rockabilly Roots of Sonny Burgess and the Pacers. He'll talk about this book and sign copies at the Fayetteville Public Library on June 26th. You mentioned baseball was a possible way out, but music was too. He's a graduate, 1948 graduate from high school. And as you mentioned, this confluence of all these things coming together, there were these great clubs. Sonny Burgess eventually, as we all know, turns to music.
Sonny was, I think, the prototype of this confluence. He's a man with one leg on the stage of music. He's a man with the other leg on the stage of the agriculture and the town history. And the two together produce this American archetype. So he's rooted in the land. He has the tradition of the worker, of the blue-collar family. No one in his family has gone to college. They listen to the radio. They listen to, this is a battery-powered radio, of course, no electricity in his childhood home. He listens to the Grand Ole Opry. He listens to the Louisiana Hayride. There are also traveling musicians from the Grand Ole Opry that come through these communities and play shows. And they play shows at theaters in town, and they play shows at these dirt floor stores out in the country, these little retail shops. And Sonny tells stories of seeing these musicians come through and going to these shows as a boy. So some of his uncles were attracted by this, and they played some music as well. Sonny listens to Hank Williams. He listens to some blues artists, some rhythm and blues artists, and he picks up the sense of playing music as fun, of course, as a teenager. So here's where another extraordinary confluence comes in. When the Rural Electric Association, REA, begins to bring electricity to the rural areas, There's electricity in Newport already since the 20s. But in the 40s, they're just bringing the electricity out to the country. REA has these information meetings to tell people what they can expect, what kind of appliances, what kind of safety issues, what the costs of having electricity in your home. At these meetings, they hire local bands to play for the crowds, to give people Coca-Colas and Hershey bars. And they hire young men, Sonny Burgess and his pals, to play for these audiences. That's where Sonny gets his first stage chops. He's playing for these REA rural informational meetings. And he's playing with a guy named Kern Kennedy, who he's been with, he and then works with for the next 65 years, his piano player. Kern is from Tuckerman. And I have photos in the book of these two thin, scrawny, graceful, athletic young men. You could see they are products of the Depression era. They came of age during the 30s. You know, they're wiry, they're handsome young men, they're wearing short-sleeved white shirts, and they're playing in front of a room full of farmers and farmers' children, and they're out there in calico dresses and eating peanuts and Coca-Cola, and it must have been a beautiful evening or afternoon. So Sonny plays this music, and it's country music. It's and a little bit upbeat because he likes the sound of faster country music. And his first band that he forms when he's a young man, a 20-year-old, is called the Rocky Road Ramblers, and that's based on a Hank Williams sound and a Hank Williams song. So this evolves, country music with the mixture of black blues and rhythm and blues, acoustic blues from the Mississippi side of the river, rhythm and blues from Chicago and points north, mixed with white country music, creating this hybrid music, this high-energy music. It's impossible to sit still. We call it rockabilly.
There is a great story in the book. It's like something out of a movie. In fact, I think we've seen variations of this, where one of the most famous DJs at the time, Ralph Emery, is at one of the most influential radio stations at the time, WSM in Nashville, and Sonny Burgess comes in. He knocks on the door. The janitor lets him in. It just reads like, you know, this ultimate rock and roll fable. And this, too, has some sort of trajectory on Sonny Burgess's career.
Absolutely. You had to market yourself, because at that point, unless you were Elvis or Jerry Lee, Sam Phillips did not have the capital to back up and push you around the country. Sonny had been on tours with other Sun Records stars. They called them package tours. They'd have older players like Bob Wills and not Hank Williams. I can't recall some other names. Oh, Patsy Cline. People of his, before his generation, would be put on stage with the younger guys like Sonny, and they would travel the country. But the way you made your money in those days was by selling records. The shows were low cost and virtually for free. You made your success by selling records, the opposite of how the music industry is today. Today, the music's virtually free on the internet and elsewhere, and stars get their megabucks through ticketed shows. Back in the day, it was the opposite. So Sonny had to take his record, We Want a Boogie, Flipside, Redheaded Woman, the first 45 out of Sun Records, and take it on the road. They took it everywhere they could, and they would just show up at radio stations and say, here's our record, can you play it? And sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't.
There is a chance that people listening to our conversation are very familiar with the names Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, others who were connected to Sun, and may not be as familiar with Sonny Burgess. He was one of the ones that didn't quite get the mega household fame that endured as some of those other superstars. But that is not to say his entertainment value and his songs were no less as great or interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I call Sonny, and I don't mean this in any detrimental way, a second-tier artist. Just as talented, just as dynamic, just as charismatic as the great names that we associate with that time, Elvis and Jerry Lee and Orbison and Cash, Sonny just didn't get the breaks. And we know that it takes more than talent to be a success in any performance industry. It takes luck, it takes timing, it takes connections. And a couple of things just didn't click for Sonny, despite the immense talent that he and his band had. Let me give you one example of that.
Okay.
45 RPM record has a song on it. It lasts for less than 3 minutes. Has to. That's the size of the record. You can't play more than 3 minutes of one song on one side of an RPM record, a 45. Sonny's group, the Pacers, would take that same song, We Want a Boogie, or Going Home, or A Redheaded Woman, and play that song live in a dance hall for 45 minutes to 1 hour. The same song, never stopping. They would create a sense of hilarity by jumping off the stage with their guitars while they're playing, taking the bass out of the audience, spinning the bass, dancing with the women, putting women's bloomers on their heads. They had these stage acts that he called the bug dance, where they would pretend they had a cockroach and they'd throw it on each other and they'd wiggle and jerk and jump around and throw it on each other. The audience would be pressing in, absolutely mesmerized with laughter. Then they'd throw the pretend bug out into the audience, and then the folks would be all wild up to act out in the same way. So they would create a dance hall presence that was legendary. You could not capture that on a record. Mm. And unfortunately, the record sales was what projected you to stardom.
You know, I once talked to Billy Lee Riley, who also had been connected to Sun and didn't hit the big time, though he had a couple of hits. And he admitted that for some amount of time, of course, he had this legendary feud with Sam Phillips, right. That he was bitter. Did you get the sense that ever Sonny Burgess, because he didn't hit that stratosphere that some other Sun artists had, was he ever bitter?
I detected no sense of that. Sonny was a remarkable personality. He seemed very comfortable in his own skin. When I met him, he was in his 70s. He was extraordinarily generous with me in terms of his memories, his introductions, his references to other people. He took time. We drove up and down Highway 67 numerous times. He introduced me to lots and lots of people. He was one of the guys that everybody seemed to like and admire. And there was a long period, quite honestly, when he was forgotten, when from 1965 till about 1985, he was working, and hard to imagine, but he was working as a salesman for a cloth store that sold bridal cloth. And he had he traveled the South. His son John told me when John was growing up, he didn't even know his father played guitar.
Oh, my.
So here's this immense talent who just accepts the fact, and I think this goes back to his farm roots. Farmers are remarkably stoic people. They will accept tragedy, disaster, success. You know, they can gamble. They like to gamble, but they're also very accepting. And Sonny was that way. He had some degrees of success. He has some exposure. And when it stopped working in 1965, when he pretty much had to give up music, that was what he had to do to support his family. And he did it with grace and with dignity. And then when circumstances came back in 1985, there he was, ready to go.
Marvin Schwartz is the author of We Want a Boogie, The Rockabilly Roots of Sonny Burgess and the Pacers. He'll discuss the book at the Fayetteville Public Library June 26th at 6 p.m. We have links to more information about the author and that event at the library at ozarksatlarge.com.
The Botanical Garden of the Ozarks welcomes terrific Tuesday nights. Now through August, the garden will be open to the public from 5 to 8 p.m. each Tuesday. A variety of programs, including family-friendly summer concerts and educational demonstrations, will be offered. Tuesday nights are free. However, $5 donations are encouraged. bgozarks.org for more. The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society opens the 20th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series with the Bill Frisell Trio, featuring Thomas Morgan and Rudy Royston, Thursday, June 14th, in the Star Theater at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. By blending rock and country with jazz and blues, Frisell is considered one of the most innovative jazz guitarists of his generation. KUAF.com or digjazz.com for tickets and information.
It really felt like summer this morning before the storms rolled into at least parts of our region. The swampy humidity makes us feel better about launching our summer reading recommendations a few days before the actual season arrives. Pastor Clint Schneckloth started his list of summer reads yesterday, and he continues on this Tuesday edition of Ozarks with a young adult novel titled Refugee by Alan Gratz. Gratz is known for his books involving children set against the Second World War and was researching another novel for that time period. But then something changed his mind.
When he was in the middle of researching that, he was in Florida. They were walking on the beach in Florida, and they come across this abandoned boat. And he's going around looking at the boat, and some guardsmen come up or something and are looking at it with him, and they're like, oh, yeah, this is definitely abandoned. Probably somebody came across. This is back in, 2014 or 2015, somebody probably has come across, landed here from Cuba, and then abandoned the boat once they got to shore. So he started thinking about that. You know, he's like, here I was going to write this historical novel about this refugee from Germany in the Second World War, but there are refugees landing right now on our beaches from Cuba. And this is when the wet foot, dry foot policy was still in place. So if people don't know what that was, there was a long stretch of time, the last 15 or 20 years, when we basically, if we caught you coming from Cuba on open water, we returned you to Cuba. But if you made it to shore, you got one foot on dry land, then you could stay. And that was our official policy, is wet foot, dry foot policy. So there were all these Cubans who would risk life and limb to make it from Cuba to our shore. And then he also, at the same time that he had that experience, was the rise in awareness of the Syrian refugee crisis. Obviously, that had already also been going on, but it came into much greater awareness in the United States and in Europe, because there was a flood of refugees that came into Europe, and Americans learned a lot more about it, seeing it in the news, and then there was a lot in our own media about the Syrian refugee crisis. So what he decided to do was to tell the story of three children, a refugee child fleeing Syria to come to Europe, a refugee child fleeing Germany in the Second World War to get to Cuba, and then this third one of a Cuban refugee child fleeing to the United States. And then those three stories are woven together seamlessly, and there's ways in which they actually end up interacting with each other, and it's totally unputdownable. It's just refugee.
And it's a scholastic book, which means good for tweens and teens.
Well, yes, it's definitely.
I mean, not exclusively, mm-hmm. but yeah, that's who could enter
yes.
in. Yeah.
It's not there's some very dismal and sad things that happen. These are refugee families fleeing persecution, danger, and it's so yeah, it's be prepared.
Pastor Clint Schneckloth is the lead pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville. Every season he brings us recommendations for books. Today he suggested the YA novel Refugee by Alan Gratz. And if you love books, this reminder, Friends of Fayetteville Public Library will host a book sale Saturday from 9 to 5 in the lobby of the library. Books, media, and other items will cost $1 or less, proceeds directed toward the library. And speaking of the library, don't forget to tune in to KUAF Friday night, June 22nd, for the KUAF Summer Swing Live radio show, honoring our two longest-running shows on 91.3, The Pick and Post with Mike Shirkey, and Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsburg. The show is sold out already, but make a night of it with us on the radio as more than a dozen great musicians like Claudia Burson, Ben Harris, Emily Cates, and Keith and Ezra from Trout Fishing America and many others join us for a once-in-a-lifetime show. From Mina to Tahlequah, from Eureka to Figure Four, tune in for a great night of music the 22nd. Help us honor two of the best sources of music in the state, Shades of Jazz and The Pick and Post. It's going to be a lot of fun. It will also serve as a one-night fundraiser for KUAF. So there is that as well. Speaking of Keith and Ezra, here they are in a recording made just for us in the Furman Garner Performance Studio last year. The song is The Strangest Times. This is 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences, Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening.
If I see a full moon rising, watch a half moon set, reach into my pocket to get what I can't get. If it all stops making sense, I know I'll be just fine. Honey, you show up, you show up, you show up at the strangest times. When everything goes never green, fences fall apart. Getting better makes it worse when I cannot start. When the coyotes howl and the wind stops on a dime. Honey, you show up, you show up, you show up at the strangest times. When the choirs fall silent and the bells won't ring, when all my days get lost and I can't find anything. It was raining in the morning, snowing hard by noon. At 5 o'clock, the world was closed and it won't reopen soon. I was wishing I weren't lonely, but feeling low and left behind. Honey, you show up, you show up, you show up at the strangest times. When the choirs fall silent and the bells won't ring, when all my days get lost and I can't find anything. That day I wrecked my car, that day I lost my job, that time I wasn't looking, that night when I got robbed. When it all starts to unravel and the clock starts to unwind. Honey, you show up, you show up, you show up at the strangest times. You show up, you show up, you show up at the strangest times.